Roll the tape. My name is Pete Steinke. The title of this session is Naming Your Ghost and Baptizing Your Hopes. I'm going to introduce you tonight. Some of you may be aware of this particular person theory, but I'm going to introduce you to a man named Murray Bowen, who is a family system theorist at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And the basic schema or paradigm that I'm going to illustrate is Dr. Bowen's. It is around this schema that I'm presently writing a book of my own, which I'm going to call Defining Yourself, Touching Others. One of the chapters in the book has the title, Naming Your Ghost and Baptizing Your Hopes. I have borrowed that from a novelist by the name of Maria Cardinal, who has written a book called The Words to Say It. In that novel, there is the statement, until you can name your ghost and baptize your hopes, you are not yet born. You are still the creation of someone else. I want you to keep that in mind as I go through this particular paradigm. Until you can name your ghost and baptize your hopes, you have not yet been born. You are still the creation of someone else. There are two basic, fundamental yearnings, forces, needs that everyone, regardless of what culture they may have been raised in, with any family they come from, has to deal with. And those two needs, the need to be separate and the need to be close. Now, traditionally, we, in our society, have, in our childhood development, urged males to be separate. We have urged females in terms of the issue of closeness. I do not believe that separateness, closeness, happens to be gender in any kind of way. There's nothing gendered about it. Whether you're male or female, you have the need to be separate and the need to be close. In fact, it's not to be separate from people, it's to be separate while in relationship. That is the key. Now, if I am afraid of closeness, I tend to go into emotional distance. If I am afraid of separateness, I tend to go towards emotional fusion. I'll explain each of these terms for you in a moment. But two basic needs, to be separate and to be close. You can already see the tension involved in those two words because they're antithetical. They're in paradox, they're in tension. Emotional distance. Emotional distance may look like independence, may look like autonomy, but emotional distance is still dependency. The rebellious teenager is not an independent, autonomous human being because in distancing from the family, if one goes too far over in differentiating from the family and going into rebellion, the teenager still needs the family over against whom to get his or her identity. This is the key. In emotional distance, people get their identity over against someone else. So it's not that I differentiate myself and I get distinctiveness, but in a distance, I get contradistinction. I'm getting my identity over against somebody else. Now, these are the kinds of individuals who always have to have an adversary. And once they annihilate one adversary, they have another adversary. These are people that will have polarized thinking, set the world up into dichotomies. They get their identity over against someone else. Now that's in distinction to the people in emotional fusion. These are the people who have difficulty standing out on their own, so their identity is only in relationship with somebody else, tucked into somebody else's life. Whereas if one has a nice sense of their own separateness, the identity comes from within oneself. And we are all struggling to develop that more for our own selves, that I define who I am. I do not define myself over against everybody else. I don't define myself by only being attached and clinging and clutchy to other people. I do some identification from within myself. Now, the other day I mentioned that the better set of boundaries you have, your own sense of separateness, the better the sense of closeness you will have, the greater the intimacy you will share with others. Because you will have defined who you are. You will have your boundaries. You will be able to let your boundaries down and get close. But once the experience is over, draw back and put your boundaries back up. Let me just diagram that for you in a moment. Somebody who is an emotional distance. This person has such thick boundaries that there's very little energy that goes out, very little energy that comes in. Now, there are times when it would be appropriate to do distancing. I just want to get out of here. I don't want to think a thought. Give me a hammock and a beer and leave me alone. And that can be very appropriate. Now, the extreme over here in emotional fusion would be a person's boundaries are very porous. Whereas if you had a nice sense of your closeness and separateness, your boundaries would have a nice flow of energy in and a nice flow of energy out. There'd be a better balance. Now, all of these can be appropriate at different stages and different places, or in between stages between any one of these three. For instance, you don't want to go to a football game with your boundaries that thick. Okay? You go to the football game and you put a little extra in the coffee. For what reason? So when you get to the game, you can go, "Aah!" You can have your boundaries down and be an infantile and act infantile. Okay? And get involved in the game and not even think about your separateness, but just get involved in what's going on. The same thing when there is sexual intercourse, it's a tremendously emotionally fusing experience. I mean, if you try to have sexual intercourse with your boundaries up, it just doesn't work. It won't happen. Okay. Now, you also recognize that this is a spectrum. We will be at any one of these places at different times with different people. We don't let our boundaries down always with any kind of person. But we, if we have a good sense of our separateness, we determine who gets inside of our territory. We determine who doesn't get inside our territory. We determine which boundaries we set up with what people, and what boundaries we let down with what people. Any questions on this? Basic diagram or schema at this point. Okay, let me go to the emotional fusion side, because this is where we find the greatest dysfunctioning. When people get their identity too much as parasites from each other. In emotionally fused families, suffer the greatest stress and take the longest to recover. Because the anxiety is so great, it produces reactivity. And with the reactivity repeated, you begin to get rigidity. Everybody maintains their position. Then you get polarity. And you've got all kinds of problems. But in emotionally fused systems or families or relationships, there's a high degree of reactivity, which is caused by a high degree of chronic anxiety. I am describing on this side families that are the alcoholic family, the dependent and codependent. These are the incestuous families. These are the families where there is abuse. These are also the families when there are just poor boundaries and people are clutchy, clingy, always on top of each other. Now, let me give you some other illustrations of how people are emotionally fused. Emotionally fused people always use the statement "we." I recently did an intervention in a congregation, and I made the observation that this pastor and his wife were, I thought, had a very emotionally fused relationship. And I thought that this pastor in his relationship with people in his congregation, he kept fusing with them, and there were no clear boundaries. Everybody thought he and his wife had a wonderful marriage. They were so close. Eventually, through this intervention, the man resigned his position. And I remember the bishop nudging me because he had seen my evaluation where I'd said this marriage was too fused and he operates with this fusion with other people. His resignation was in his name and his wife's name. We. No distinction between the two. In emotionally fused families, doors are never locked. Doors are always open. In emotionally fused family, nakedness is rampant. In emotionally fused families, you mind read. Oh, I knew John would do it before John even. I tell you, I know when John does what John's going to do. You finish sentences for other people. And most of all, you define other people. You are a real turkey. In emotionally fused families, there's always somebody defining the other and the other defining so what. Because the you statement puts you in the blame position. Whereas in the I statements, you're in the agency separateness position. These are some of the symptoms of emotionally fused families. There's no permission to be separate. There's this clutchy, clingy, and no allowing people to have their own thoughts, their own feelings, their own behavior. In emotionally fused systems, closeness is sameness. Therefore, everybody has to think alike, feel alike, behave alike. All right, but in these systems, and we all have some fusion, by the way. We just don't all see ourselves in the middle, by the way. And I'll explain that in a little bit in a minute. But we all tend towards fusion. All groups, all relationships tend towards fusion. You know, what is the romantic stage of love but fusion? Everybody is blind. Love begins as an illusion. The Greeks were smart. Cupid is blind. Everybody loses their senses. So somebody asked me, you know, what about premarital counseling? I said, I really don't believe in premarital counseling. I said, what can you do with two psychotics? Because it's just people are out of their minds. I just don't have a lot of hope in premarital counseling. Now, but eventually, the honeymoon always ends when what? When somebody gets in touch with his or her separateness. Then the fusion is over. That happens in other situations, too. When somebody finally gets their own sense of separateness, the fusion is over. Now, I believe congregations tend to be highly emotionally fused. And they are not always the healthiest situations. Because congregations do not always allow for separateness. I'm not saying congregations everywhere. I'm just saying, generally, congregations tend towards fusion. And usually the older the congregation, the more rural the congregation, where closeness is sameness, you know, those tend to be more emotionally fused systems. All right. Meanwhile, over here in the emotional distance side, this too is reactive, just as people here will be reactive. I need to have enemies and adversaries and opponents to have my identity. I just can't do it from within myself. I always do it over against somebody else. This is as dependent and reactive as folks over here. These are the people who tend to become very opinionated, very dogmatic, extremely rational, cool, and aloof. Now, one of the ironies is you can have a fused relationship where one person in a relationship is fused and one is distancing. It's fused because neither one is operating out of their separateness. You see, this is a perversion of a nice sense of separateness. This is overdoing it, over-differentiating. Whereas here, the lines are very blurred. There's very little differentiation. Any questions or comments at this point? Yes.
Into both of them heavily and not be in the middle?
Well, to get in the middle really is to become mature. What I'm describing here is the extremes are the immaturities in life.
Can you be into both extremes?
Yes, you can. I know some clients, in order to get out of the fusion, have had to go into the rebellion and do the distancing. I've had to help them recognize that the rebellion really isn't going to be the answer, though it sometimes looks that way, that they're going to have to move back here and get their separateness. I have a client, a pastor's wife. She and her husband have a 15-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old daughter. Throughout the school year of 1988-89, the 15-year-old did not go to school. They came to me because they were at wit's end. They tried everything over the year, and now they were going to commit the 15-year-old daughter to a psychiatric hospital. I said to her, I really hope you don't do that. I said, I'm going to tell you something that you may not hear at first and you may not like. But I think you and your daughter have colluded with each other to keep one another close. How could your 15-year-old daughter get your attention better than by not going to school since you're a teacher? See, she's having trouble separating from you. I know from this woman's family of origin, she was adopted when she was 6 years of age, and there's a lot of emotional fusion in her background. So she's trying to keep her daughter close by taking care of her. I said, you have a terrorist in your house, and you have to treat your daughter as a terrorist. I said, she's a rebellious teenager. That's a redundancy, but that's what she is. And you have simply fused with her. You are trying to save her. I said, you need to change your behavior. Besides, I said, if you send her to the psychiatric hospital, that puts you and your husband off the hook. And I think that's where the crux of the problem is, you and your husband's marriage. Now, I do not know when I get back whether she's going to continue or not, but that's how I see that situation. A lot of collusion, secret, not known to people, of how things are being arranged to keep this fusion going. The fear of either one becoming separate or the other one going out and being separate. Okay. Yes?
Does the emotionally distant husband choose the fusing wife in our society?
Very often we do have the male on this side. But it's still a collusion with the other person. See, when I see this relationship, a distancing male and a fusing female, neither one is good or bad, right or wrong. Each one has their own immaturity. And each one is adapting, setting up different defenses to keep away from being close. But they've colluded to make this arrangement. That may have been the way their parents related, or they may even take opposite sex role, but they arrange a relationship this way. And in a sense, it's very helpful. It's either going to be destructive in the long run, or it's going to lead to what? Growth. They're going to fight this out or work this thing out. But basically, the male tends to be the distancer and the female, the fuser. That doesn't have to be true, though, in every situation. And one other thing. This talks about reciprocal relationships. This means that he distances. Why? Because she fuses. She contains that need for the couple. He contains in his behavior this need for the couple. Now, when they first get together in romance, that sounds great. Yeah, hey, I feel complete now. You can do all the screaming and hollering. I'll do all the rational thinking. And we get together and we feel like one whole person. But in the beginning, it works. But it doesn't hold. Sooner or later, the rational person may say, hey, I'm getting some feelings I need to feel. The other will say, hey, no, that's my job to feel. You go back and think. Okay? And see, it becomes reciprocal. But the growth point is you, partner, must deal with your own separateness, closeness. I, other partner, must deal with it for myself. I can't ask you to contain one or the other for me. But in the beginning, we reciprocate. One does one because the other does the other. Now, what happens most of the time? We think the other is out of their mind and at fault, right? If you would function a different way, we'd be better off. Not knowing that I've colluded with my partner, my partner's colluded with me to set up the situation that's there, and we have to work on the relationship. You see, this is what happens. In any emotional system, the relationship gains a life of its own. So what I often have to do with a client is, what is yours, what belongs to the others, and what is yours together, plural, as a couple. I have a couple in which she has borderline characteristics, so she's very clutchy, clingy. She still calls her mother twice a week. She's 49 years of age. She and her husband have been married for 26 years. They've had a fairly dysfunctional marriage. She is now in individual therapy with another therapist. I'm dealing with her and her husband in marital therapy. But he's there sitting complaining about her. See what she does? She crowds me all the time. She didn't let me have my any room to breathe. She's always down my neck. Okay? So he's trying to get me to side with him. Ha, ha, ha. You know, I know every time everybody comes into marital therapy, he's thinking, boy, Pete, if you can change her, this thing's going to really go. And he's thinking just the opposite. I'm thinking, folks, you got to work on this baby together. So there's a lot of stuff you got to play around with in the beginning. But this couple finally is beginning to recognize something because he's not focusing on her all the time now. And I'm telling her not to focus on him. When you have problems, I'll give you one simple solution. You don't focus on the other person. You got to focus on yourself. The other person's not going to change as easy as you are. You have more control over changing yourself than you have changing someone else. But this is the key thing. If you begin to change how you function, what's the other person going to have to do? Going to have to change. The reciprocity deal is going to change. Now, believe me, they're not going to send you any postcards or send you any award money because you've made a change. The first thing they're going to do is try to sabotage it. And that would be true of any one of us here. When our partner changes, we're going to try to sabotage it. Because we would rather stay with what is familiar than with what is unfamiliar, even if what is familiar is painful and not functioning. That is what is the family therapist called the law of homeostasis. All relationships, groups, tend to be conservative. They want stability and coherence, and they want things to remain the same. And if you don't believe me, I always tell clergy, try to introduce a new hymnal. You'll understand the principle of homeostasis. And the same thing goes on in our relationships. Now, when families get stuck and it's just not working well, it's because they're staying in this reciprocal position, reinforcing it, and like a tire stuck in mud, just digging it deeper and not being able to get out. And then very often, therapy is helpful to help them see where they're stuck, what they need to move from where they are. Any other questions or comments at this time? Okay, I want to go back to anxiety and reactivity. How now do I relate to my partner so we get out of the reactivity to reactivity? Oh, you're not going to take me out tonight. And that's what you said 3 weeks ago. Well, you can just go and work your whole life away. That's fine. Well, what do you mean? I try to do these things for you, dear. And you know I'm making this money to keep the family alive. You know, and you can go back and forth. Now you got anxiety being raised in one person, the other person becoming anxious, and then you get reactivity to reactivity. Boom, 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 boom. Okay. It's not going to work. You cannot communicate to anybody or with anybody unless that person is moving in your direction. And the minute you begin to do the reactivity, what happens? Where's everybody going? Opposite directions. It's just impossible to communicate if somebody is not moving in your direction. Now, criticism, nagging, bitching, gritching, call it what you want, is what is called pursuit behavior. The person who criticizes, nags, etc., is in a pursuit position. I'm going to get you. All right. It doesn't feel like that person wants to get close, does it? It feels like the person is an enemy. But that often happens. That's one way people try to get close, is through criticism. It actually feels like the person's trying to divide. But criticism is pursuit. And then I keep you close. Especially if you get on the defensive and start giving explanations for your behavior or justifications for your feelings, then you're beginning to react to somebody else's reactivity. And then the whole ball game is over again because everybody's into their anxiety. What Murray Bowen has said, and it's so crucial, is that the person who has a good sense of separateness is able to distinguish thought and feeling as separate entities. People who are into the fusion side confuse thought and feeling. In fact, those on a fusion side tend to go mostly into feeling and do not think. Whereas if you're into your separateness, you can step back from the situation for a moment and think it out. Remember I said the other day that without awareness, you simply do not have choice. So yeah, the mind has to be used and implemented somewhere. And if you remember McLean's triune brain I put on the board the other day, the limbic system is the medium size, and the reptile is the smallest size of the brain. The largest was the cerebral cortex, this is thinking. That's one of the great things about being a human being. You can use your head and think. You don't have to be anxious and reactive. But unfortunately, folks who grow up in emotionally fused systems or families tend to be less thinking families, more reactive, more emotive, more anxious. But as I said before, they suffer the greatest stress. They take the longest time to recover. So I have to begin to use some thought. I don't have to react to you. All right? Let's say I come home angry and I'm mad at the world. One of the best things my wife could do for herself and me would be to say, I hear you're angry, but I don't want to fight. She then would not get into my displacement of anger about other things and let it get caught up in our relationship. And using I statements, so important to have your separateness. Your separateness, if you want to work on it, you begin to use I statements and take I positions. I will do this. I will not do this. I value this. I statements would be, I want, I feel, I need, I believe, rather than the you statements. You know, if you would shape up, our marriage would be great. The I statement would be, I want our marriage to be better. I want to work on it. I want to invite you to join me in the effort. Those are far different statements. I'll tell you, the minute you begin in the you statements, where's the other person going to be? Defense. And or getting their Pentagon ready. Brum, 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 to retaliate. See. So when the war gets going on, you know, it's better to be in touch with your own Pentagon than the others, because you're going to be more in control of who you are. Because I have this little formula, H-E equals R-O. The hostility in the environment is equal to the response of the organism. Which means then, when there's hostility in the environment, the greatest thing you can do is look at yourself and your own response. And can you think some things out and stand back and not become reactive? Murray Bowen calls separateness being a non-anxious presence. That's not always easy, but it only becomes, I can't even say it becomes easy, but it only becomes more part of who you are by practicing it. All right. Any more questions? Yes.
You were talking about emotional fusion and people being reactive and not
People could become defensive and reactive here by rationalizing everything, correct, as a way to avoid closeness. And that would be their reactivity. A lot of head stuff. But you see, the head stuff here is not being used in terms of how I can relate to you. The head stuff here is what? How I can defend myself against you. So that's where thinking becomes more of a reactivity than a real thought-out process. It's emotionally tainted because I'm afraid. I'm really afraid of intimacy. Now, Murray Bone claims that we marry individuals who have the same level of self-differentiation, same degree of boundaries as we do. Murray Bone. He says there are a number in here who got a lot of good DNA, he says, from their mothers and were able to give permission to be a self. But he says there's a good number in here, but the greatest number happened to be down from 0 to 25. Now, I'd like to say this. Even if you would be down lower on the scale, let's say at 15, and you were to move up to 20, made a five-step improvement. To me, that is a significant improvement. We get all fouled up about statistics today. And we think if we're going to change, I have to change 50% or 100%. A 5% change in your life is a magnificent change. Very, very important. I hope you don't get mixed up by numbers and percentages. It's like a teenage girl was in, because her father's a pastor and mother are getting divorced, and she broke up with her boyfriend. And she says, why should I get married? You know, one out of every two marriages taking place today is going to end in divorce anyway. Look at my parents. And she was angry at her parents. But I said to her, well, which side of the 50% you want to be on? You know, as if what? She was the victim of the statistics. One out of two are going to get divorced. And all of a sudden, to help her realize, she had a choice. She could do something about it. She could make some response to it. I think it's a little artificial, but what Murray Bone is trying to describe is everybody has a different level of self-differentiation. There are some that are going to be more clutchy, clingy, enmeshed, fused in all their relationships. There'll be some that have a greater sense of their separateness. Now, Murray Bone does make the statement that if there is some event in life that is extremely traumatic, even the most separate person will be subject to great anxiety, even as somebody who emotionally fused was. Which is to take in the fact of some of our finitude and just plain relativity of human beings. All right, let me take some more questions. I saw a couple of hands. Yes?
You're saying the I statement, but would the other person react to that in thinking that you were trying to domineer the situation? I am going to do something rather than, putting it more in the middle?
Okay. You're raising a good question because when you make the I statements, you got to remember you're making the I statements in order to stay in touch. You're not making the I statement in order to isolate. So it's very tricky. You have to define yourself. You have to make the I statement, but you still have to stay in touch with the other person. Now, the other person may feel, boy, are you arrogant? Are you egotistical? Who are you? Especially if the person is, and your whole relationship's been more towards the fusion. Yeah, like I said, they're going to try to sabotage it. But it's just, that's why I like to work with couples in therapy to get them to use more and more I statements. Just as to recognize that you've got to focus on who you are. Stop focusing on your partner, because everybody's focused on their partner. Warm voice?
comfortable.
It's much easier to hear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how you made the I statement is a good point. Mm-hmm. There was another hand here. Yes.
What sort of things can a couple do to move from those outer bounds to, I mean, are there certain things like don't have so many activities together or have more activities together? Or are there certain things that a person can do to...
Well, I'm going to say this. The couple, each individual has to work on their own separateness. And in doing that, they will create a greater closeness. Now, it may be that sometimes couples need to get some separation. Maybe they need to get more opportunity together. I couldn't determine that. But see, I'm looking at more at the emotional things. What's going on? How do they keep themselves fused? Or how have they kept themselves so reactive to each other? Well, for instance, with this couple I was talking about, that she has some borderline characteristics, but he's such a distancer that he creates it. And the more he distances, what does she do? The more she pursues, the more she criticizes, the more she nags. So I'm saying, if you want her to stop nagging, stop distancing. Simple. You're over-functioning as distancer, so she under-functions as distancer. You're going to have to change the process. Now, one of the things that happened in that relationship, trying to think of what I've got them doing the next 3 weeks. I gave him some assignments, so he is taking the pursuer role. And that she has to, forcing her to take the distancer role. See, in a good, healthy relationship, people can switch roles. At one moment, somebody can be the fuser, somebody can be the isolator. In dysfunctional systems, the roles are inflexible. They got to be the way they were before. And see, that's that old homeostasis, that resistance to change. I couldn't tell you what you or your partner should do unless I could see you and your partner, what has to be done to help each one look at what's going on in the system. But you never lose by defining yourself, as opposed to defining everybody else in fusion, or really over here in distancing, you're defining other people too in rebellion. See, over here in fusion, you have a lot of rescuers. This is where the codependent are, who take care of all the dependents. They come over and they rescue. They're messiahs. They're saviors. I mean, I got clergy up to here that I deal with that are fusers. See? I think they came out of families where, well, they did. They came out of their families. See, in clergy, 90% of the clergy that I have came out of families where the father was emotionally distant or unavailable. So they're still always in pursuit of this unavailable person. So they're going to come over here now and fuse and pursue everybody. You know, I remember in the parish, you know, I spent all this time going after delinquents. Man, you make a visit, and then next Sunday, what happens? Attendance is up. You know, folks have come. The next Sunday, what happens? They're gone. They're back to distancing again, waiting for me to come over and make a call and be a pursuer. Well, I wouldn't do that anymore. I'd go make calls. If I was back in the parish, say, look, I want you to know that I'm the pastor, and if you need me, call me. And if you're not coming to worship service, it's your responsibility. But I'm not going to come chasing you. See, I think some of the system that we built up in the church, we have built up the horrible dependency, codependency stuff, and encouraged some real pathological behaviors in the church. It's not my responsibility as pastor that you be a church or that you participate or you're in stewardship. See? If I were in a parish, I'd spend more time now defining myself and who I am and encouraging more separateness and parishioners. Now, granted, there are times when people get in dependent situations, in traumas and crises, and they need someone there, you know, for strength. But there can be just too much dependency. I used to be this savior. They called me up 2:00 in the morning. I was out in the car in 3 minutes. And there are some cases where that may be necessary. But to be in that constant pursuit behavior, what are you creating among parishioners? Distancing behaviors. I have a very good pastor that I'm dealing with, and he has this woman in his church that has really come on strong criticizing him. Last Christmas, she came on strong to him sexually, while his wife was out of town. And he got scared, and he backed off. Okay. Now, rather than talking about this with his wife or somebody else, he's in his scared position. All right? So she still comes on, but he would withdraw to the point where he wouldn't even talk to her, look at her, or anything else. So the more he withdrew because of this sexual threat that he felt, what did that do to her? I'm going to get you one way or the other. You know, it's either going to be in bed or it's going to be at the church council. All right. Finally, you know, I said to him, why are you so hooked into this antagonist? You've had other antagonists. You're a good pastor. And he went back to the fact of being threatened. And he said, well, I got to tell you the truth. She's very attractive. And I have some emotional feelings for her. So he, you know, see, that's his reactivity to her reactivity. And he said, it reminds me of an old girlfriend and she has beautiful ankles. There were other things, too, as we got to the truth. So he finally had to say to her, because now she wasn't getting the good things she wanted by doing good things, so how's she going to get the things she wants? By doing bad things. I mean, if you can't get it by doing good things, what are you going to do eventually? You're going to try to get it by doing bad things. That's what the child does, and that's what the child does and the adult still, too. So he finally confronted her and said, look, I cannot give you pastoral care, and I think you're going to have to go to another congregation because I'm not going to allow my ministry to be destroyed by your gossiping and criticism of me, and it's coming to an end. What was he doing? Defining himself, setting up his boundaries. See? And getting out of the soup. This is soup. This is mushy. And once he set up his boundaries, you know, the other person backed off. I always say to clergy, you got to define who you are in a parish. It's just a job that you just can't go around with fuzzy boundaries. And the folks are going to sabotage you and all of that. Because, see, the highly dependent always are the most reactive. They have the highest stake in the relationship. If you begin to get in your separateness, what do the dependent do? Try to suck you back in, hold you, correct? Because they have the most at stake in a relationship. But what I think Murray Bowen has said is all over this world, the most dependent hold all the power. What we really need to do is to work with folks who have a good sense of separateness and help them to define themselves so that there's not so much of this pull of the dependent, not so much reactivity going on in our world. You ever watch Oprah Winfrey's show or one of these other, the reactivity that goes on? Well, it's kind of interesting. Someone has done a study and have recognized that a number of the people that go to these shows and watch them have some borderline personality characteristics. See? I mean, it just fits. See? I mean, hey, it's great. I don't have to do with my husband. I can do with what? Somebody on that screen. Be reactive, reactive, reactive. And watch them on a screen. It's reactive to reactive. Very, very fascinating. Okay, we've got just 5 more minutes for questions. Any more questions? Yes?
I thought it was a joke, but I've seen a picture of two men talking together, and one man is saying, my wife and I, we sleep in separate beds, and we go on separate vacations. We're doing everything we can to keep our marriage together.
It's not so much a joke, you bet. I will say to couples, and even now, I realize I can do marital therapy if I just have one person. Because I know if that person's the most motivated person in the system, that person will change, and that's going to change the whole system. The person that wants to either make some correction in the distancing or the fusion, and it's usually the person who has the greatest pain. Because, see, pain's a great motivator. I will not take away any pain my patients have. That's my ally. Because pain wants a response. Any pain you have, physical, mental, anything, wants a response, correct? It's one good thing about pain. So these people will be motivated. And I'll work with them, and what do you want to do? Who do you want to be in this relationship. Then when you change who you are and you change some of your functioning positions and your roles in the family, okay, then you're going to change the whole system. Now, I grew up as the third of six children. So I'm right there in the mediator, go-between situation, you know. So I learned how to make everybody happy. And I learned how to be a pleaser. I could, you know, go out, be a pleaser, make sure everybody feels good. That got to be a point I didn't like it anymore. So I had to learn to deal more with defining myself. It's still my issue. There's no magic. It's kind of an attitude, and always to remember that your relationship's a process. It's always moving. It's always something's always happening, or you're either reliving the same old process.
What you just said, I think, goes against a lot of what of current teaching about family, saying that you've got to have the couple in order to do.
That's true. That's true. But I believe if you. Yeah, I've changed my thinking on that too. And if I have the most motivated person, it's going to change their functioning position. It's going to affect the whole system. Now, I usually say to folks, look, if you're going to come into therapy individually, it's going to affect your marriage. If this is effective, it's going to affect your marriage. So you got to go home and tell your partner. You know, I've got a beautiful couple right now that's just starting to come around. And I know they're really enjoying this week. She's in her third marriage, pastor's wife. She thought that if I took care of everybody else's needs, what would happen to my needs? They would be taken care of. She got in two marriages of 8 years apiece, but in each marriage, what happened? Nobody took care of her needs. But she never asked for what she needed, correct? But the deal was, I'll take care of your needs, and you'll give me back what I need. Now she's married to a pastor who's in his second marriage. He is the par excellent distancer, okay? I mean, she's setting up the same old thing again, correct? I'm going to go after that hard-to-get person, but now she's been in therapy and she's recognizing I'm not getting my needs met in this relationship either. I have to change. She announced her husband she's going to therapy and she was going to change. All right? I called him in and said, you know, what do you want to do? She's making some progress, and I don't think this marriage is going to last. Well, he came in and he started working. And we found out from his family of origin, his mother double-binded him all the time. You know, Bob, you never kiss me. So Bob would give him a kiss. Oh, the only reason you kiss me, Bob, is because mommy had to tell you. Double-bind. You never win, see? That can cause craziness. And some folks do go into illusion and to get out of that craziness that's there. So she double-bind. Then, you know, he's afraid of sexuality and touch. Finally, he came out and said, my mother had an affair with a boarder. My sister is the child of that affair. So how does mother feel about sex? Anxious. Don't you ever get a girl pregnant before marriage. So he absorbs all of mom's anxiety about sex because she had this affair with a boarder and here's this daughter, born of it. Okay. Now, one thing his wife wants is touch. Feels that that's really missing in their relationship. So she's asking for it. Now, in the next 2 weeks, he has the assignment that he has to touch her every other day. And if there is to be any sex, he has to initiate it. Okay? Trying to change the whole roles and system. He's agreed to it. But now it's less of a threat because the stuff is getting out. See, that's why, as long as it's secret, as long as it's hidden, you can't deal with it. And anything that's hidden has energy. It takes energy to keep it hidden, you see. And it is frightening to expose some things. It is threatening to put some things out on the table. But you don't change it if you can't see it. You're not aware of it. You can't, there's nothing there. You go back and repeat the old stuff. So even those little changes, and sometimes, you know, you set up gimmicks, but gimmicks teach. I'm only trying to teach, and if the gimmick helps, then I'll use the gimmick. Okay, my time is just about up. Question?
What do you do if you're in an authority position, like a pastor or a teacher, and there's a really heavy fuser who is it good to draw attention to the fact that you're trying to see it, or should you only try to separate yourself? Because you already are somewhat separated as an authority.
Okay, that's the church mouse and the brown noser. The church mouse for the pastor and the brown noser for the teacher. You have to remember that you've got somebody who's highly dependent, tries to fuse by probably being nice, doing things for you, or may just be the opposite, criticized, whatever. You have to be in control of that by defining who you are and saying, I can talk to you for 5 minutes if it's a lot of time they want. You set limits. That's one thing. You've got to set limits to those kinds of folks. They don't know how to set them, see. The boundaries are so weak. You have to set the wing. Now, also remember, these folks may not like that. And we'll try to sabotage it or retaliate. But you got to stay the course. I find eventually if you define yourself, keep your boundaries up, folks will get the message that they can't do these tricks with you like they do with others. Is this okay? Yes. That's a good question, because tomorrow I'm going to use this model using the Isaac and Rebecca's marriage and Jacob and Esau. I think that's a dysfunctional family. Yeah, I really do. And God has used a dysfunctional family, and that's part of the beauty of Scripture, that God can use even our dysfunctioning for His purposes. But I want to use this model in terms of spirituality, and I'm going to take off with that marriage. Okay? Thank you. Actually, there's a student of his that's written about his work, and it's better than his original book. And it just came out. It's called Family Evaluation. And the author is Michael Kerr, K-E-R-R. It takes a little time to get through it all, but it's very worthwhile. Family Evaluation, Michael Kerr. Yes. Yes. Dealing with your discontent. It's not on this model. No, this is the one I'm writing the book now is on this model.
Okay. Is this the book that he's going Reformation that was covered in the last week?
Some of it, yeah. Some of it, and I'll get some of it next week, too.
Yeah. Give me, okay, I went to a session earlier this year.
Here?
Reactivity, no, it's not. Okay, two get people up, standing up, couples. And one person is the reactor, one is the reactive. You wave your hands around. I'm trying, waiting for somebody to respond. There's a signal.